Welcome to episode 3 of the Creator Spotlight podcast. Today's guest is Casey Lewis, who writes After School, a newsletter tracking youth consumer trends and Gen Z insights. Casey has been writing either about or for teenagers since she was one and had a blog called Teen Fashionista, but she never thought of herself as a creator until this past year. After School is actually one of a few newsletters I actively read, so this was a particularly fun episode for me personally, and I hope will be a particularly fun one for you to listen to. For our readers, for our subscribers, give me the little quick, who is Casey Lewis background?
Oh gosh, so I think I would self-identify as a writer and editor first and foremost. I went to journalism school. I grew up obsessed with teen magazines. I really saw like a life for myself as like moving to New York and being an editor of a teen magazine. And then I did go to journalism school and I did move to New York. And then the journalism or the media industry, as we know, it's sort of, you know, was already crumbling. Like I was an intern at Teen Vogue one summer, but then I was a ASME intern the next summer, which they place you and they pay you, which is great because no internships at that point were paid. But shortly after I did this internship, the magazine folded and I hadn't even graduated yet. So then so there were signs of what was to come in the media industry. And, but I would identify as an editor and a writer. Yeah. That's the through line through my career, though it has sort of manifested in different ways.
Which is interesting because like the whole idea of like, what is a creator? How do you define that? Like is kind of complex. And like, I place you in that camp because you have this newsletter, but like with Clover Letter, I don't know, would I have called you a creator? I think now maybe yes. With my definition is kind of broad. Anyways, let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to Teen Fashionista, I found it because I was looking up like, I don't know. I was like just trying to find surprising things of you. And I looked up like you and your college graduating class. I found this article from you about you from December 2006 in the Columbia Missourian.
Yeah. Am I sitting in a closet? I'm sitting in a closet.
Yes. I've got it up right here. And so I found it all through that, but it was really cool. And I don't know, tell me like about starting Teen Fashionista and then what happened with it. Cause it still exists, but
no,
it's just kind of like an affiliate marketing shell. Well, no. The URL does, but it's just like an affiliate marketing shell.
Oh, wow.
Clearly you're not involved with that.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
Oh, wow. I actually have not looked this up. Wow. Okay. So it lapsed a long time ago. Obviously I'm no longer a teen, but when I just grew up truly obsessed with media and loved writing and started it was an email newsletter, but it was a listserv about fashion when I was probably 12. And that was the sort of first iteration, I guess, or the first, like my first life as a creator sort of effort. Of course, we didn't identify as creators then, but I had this listserv about fashion and then tools like Blogger came out. And so I started experimenting with a blog. And back then it was pretty early days of blogging, and the blog role on the side, it was sort of how you would get, you know, essentially like referrals. I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of a blog role, but it was like the top echelon of the like sort of fashion blogs would all recommend one another. And then if you could show up, it's just like a cosign on Twitter, like, you know, any newsletter platform these days. But I sort of just wrote every day. I remember either reading or someone gave me a piece of advice that if you want to be a writer, just write every day. And I took that to heart. And so I would sit down on my family computer and like write a musing about like Chanel or you know, just whatever, Gap. Like it didn't, and I'm from a small town in Missouri. So my exposure to fashion was limited to basically 17 magazine, then Teen Vogue, but I was obsessed with fashion and loved like to learn about it on the internet. So I started this blog, Teen Fashionista, and I wish I could remember traffic numbers, but it grew. And so I, you know, living in rural Missouri, ended up going to South by Southwest and speaking on a panel called Meet Judy Jetson. And I remember the invite came into my inbox and I had to tell my parents, like, I've been invited to South by Southwest.
How old were you?
I think I could look back, but I think I was 13 or 14. And then my senior year of high school, I went to Fashion Week in New York. And living in New York was my dream. I'd never been to New York. And I remember I saw Atusa Rubinstein, who was the editor-in-chief of Cosmo Girl and then 17. And I went up to her and I gave her a Teen Fashionista card that I had made from like a family friend who was a printer.
That's so sick. And then, so I read that you, actually, before we move on, when did you shut it down? As best I could tell, it was like kind of 2010, around when you graduated college. You looked
yeah,
like you stopped
so, it. Yeah, I, well, you know, as I got older, like I started it probably when I was literally 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. And then as I got like closer to 20, I was sort of like, huh, like this can't continue forever. But then I did move to New York after I graduated, and then I started working at Teen Vogue. And at that time, Condé Nast or like any corporation was not enthusiastic about you having like a side gig, and like side hustles weren't a thing. And so I remember, like, I don't know if anybody ever said that I should not do that on the side, but it was sort of implied that you shouldn't have like side gigs.
Yeah. How times have changed.
Yes, I know. I mean, it's crazy. I remember an editor getting chastised for being too much on Twitter, which like that goes to show how different platforms are and how important it is for these magazines that their editors have followings. But at the time it was sort of like your personal brand, quote unquote, should be your brand that you work for.
Like, yeah. I also found your fashion.about.com.
Oh my column. Gosh. You like really went. Yeah. Oh yeah. So that's
Casey's clicks.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. Well, you're reminding me of things that I, yeah. So that was how I went to Fashion Week actually. So I had my blog, and then the editor of fashion.about.com became sort of a mentor of mine.
Cynthia
and
Ellis.
Yes. Yes. And is an amazing woman. She no longer works in media as so many people who started in media, you know, but she was amazing and let me write about teen fashion for her site. And at that time, .about.coms were like pretty big, and it was awesome exposure for my newsletter. And I can't remember if I think she paid me. And I'm almost positive she paid me, and I'm sure it wasn't much. It shouldn't have been much, because I was like, literally, you know, and I do remember I had to get my parents' permission to do it. Like, I think my parents had to email her and be like, this is okay. But then that led to, I was the editor of prom.about.com. And that actually brought in good money because it was like affiliate revenue early days. And I can't remember if I was in high school or college when I think I was in high school still. But yeah, I was obsessed with fashion. And so I would do like runway to prom or, you know, like sort of like, or red carpet, stuff like that. Yeah, you really, you're reminding me of things that I totally forgot about.
That's, well, I hope so. No, I wrote this down actually. Casey's clicks is like, it's so proto after school. There was like on the website, there's this thing. It said, Teen scene. Stay on top of the latest teen fashion trends by checking out these articles, all written by teen fashion expert Casey Lewis of teenfashionista.com. It's the same thing, right? Like,
it's
you're
so
doing
funny.
The same thing.
Yeah, I'm nothing if not. Yeah. So funny. I've gotten older, but my interests have remained the same.
Yeah, which is really interesting. It's almost like I wonder if in 5 years, is everything on the if you're still doing after school, is everything on the about page going to change from Gen Z to Gen Alpha? Like, is it, I don't think it's necessarily Gen Z culture you're interested in as much as it is teen culture. You were writing about teen culture as a teen. Now you're writing, but like as Gen Z becomes, you know, 20 somethings, 30 somethings.
Yep.
Do you still write about them, or is it Gen Alpha?
I think you're totally right in that it's youth culture that I'm interested in, mm-hmm. and not Gen Z. And I think, you know, when I was in college, I also worked at this website called Y Pulse, which is sort of a youth insights intelligence. It's changed a lot since then, but it was like a very scrappy, like early days website. If you look it up on internet, you know, it's awesome. And it's sort of, you'll see like that, you'll see how that experience sort of led me to doing after school, because I was like tasked with basically scouring the internet and finding relevant to youth marketers articles. And my, so really, like, I've been doing a version of this for a long time, but I, you know, at that point, youth trends were millennials and I was a millennial, but you know, now it's, and I think throughout my career, I've like, I've both reported on youth trends for youth, like with Clover Letter, that was for teens. And, but now it's like, I'm interested in both telling teen stories, but also for teens, the audience, and also adults as the audience. And I think that's what I'm genuinely more interested in at this point.
Yeah. You touched on Clover Letter. Can we get into that? As far as I know, it's, you did it for about 3 years with a friend, with a co-founder.
Yeah.
Got to 200,000 subscribers.
Yeah.
You were acquired. You had a cool referral system that was like proto, what, you know, Beehive or Substack has built in today.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find anything really about, you launched an app. I couldn't really find anything about monetization. So tell me all about Clover Letter.
I'd worked at Teen Vogue, gone to MTV, gone back to Teen Vogue, was getting increasingly disillusioned with the media, state of media. Of course, now it's way worse, but, and my friend was working, one of my closest friends, we knew each other since we were interns. I was an intern at Teen Vogue at the time that she was an intern at Elle Girl, which no longer exists. And we just were, you know, we would get beers in Williamsburg after our, you know, assistant jobs and talk about how beholden we were to clickbait and what a shame it was, like, not only for us professionally, but for these young readers. Like, I was seen at Teen Vogue, like the top stories would be Kylie Jenner dyes her hair and all that traffic is coming through Facebook. And it would just, it sucked because we were like doing these wonderfully reported stories that weren't getting any traction. And everyone was like working themselves to the bone. And for what? And at that time, there was, email was starting to bubble up. The Skim was a big success story at the time. Lena Dunham came out with Lenny Letter. There were just some interesting examples of like sort of this newsletter wave that we're in now. But we were especially inspired by the Skim, which had, I mean, they raised a ton of money and we thought that was cool. And, but also they just, their growth story was crazy. And part of that, of course, was because they raised, you know, but so my friend and I put in a notice at our jobs. We sat down, created a couple of like example newsletters, decided we were going to launch on X date. This was 2016. And because we had been reporters at, you know, different publications, we knew how to pitch ourselves. So we reached out to Women's Wear Daily, New York Times. We got all this press just because we sort of like somewhat through our relationships, but also just we knew what appealed to, you know, when you're on the receiving end of a pitch. But the newsletter really did grow very quickly in a way that we didn't expect. And if I do say so, like in retrospect, I'm like, wow, that was kind of brilliant. So every day we featured a teen girl, and this speaks to the time, but we would look on Instagram and look at the tagged locations of high schools. And then we would then DM these people and say like, you seem awesome. We are starting, we're former editors of Teen Vogue and Nylon. We're starting this new newsletter. We think you'd be into it and we'd love to feature you. And so then we'd feature them and we'd be like, no, please share, you know? And so we would, these girls would be flattered and then they would be interested. And I think that people are kind of inundated with DMs more so this at this point. But in 2016, like they, you know, these young girls were sort of like, wow, cool, okay. And so then it sort of snowballed and then girls would be like, can I write for you? And so very quickly, Liza and I went from writing the entire thing every day to girls would want to write essays about mental health or like advice columns, or we were like suddenly getting all these pitches from teenage girls. And so it just, it did snowball from there. And we grew to 200,000 subscribers with a lot of, you know, we did every sort of growth thing that you, I mean, we didn't buy any subscribers, but we tried all sorts of stuff. It was awesome to build out a brand, to have this, to have these relationships with these girls, to see the need that we were filling, because it wasn't clickbait. That's the nice thing about email is like, you really do get to sidestep the whole clickbait thing. but we didn't stay in the business long enough to like see that through. So mm-hmm. we started thinking about the next step. It was a hard time in media. We were seeing a lot of companies shut down or not being able to raise the next round. I mean, nothing's changed. And so we started talking to potential acquirers, and Awesomeness TV at the time was like a huge YouTube influencer network. And they were interested in exploring email and like real girl sort of like, you know, more like issues. And so they acquired us, which was not like,
it wasn't the exit of, it was not a Morning Brew exit.
It was not a Morning Brew exit. My co-founder and I were relieved to just sort of like be in a steady spot again and to not be on that treadmill. And we joined the Awesomeness, and then 3 months later they were acquired by Viacom. So then suddenly we're doing this newsletter basically under this huge giant, and no one gives a shit about 200,000 subscribers in email list at a place like Viacom. So then, yeah, they started like cutting resources. You know, we were supposed to have all these resources. They started cutting resources. They were like, actually, can you guys just send it twice a week? We'd like you to work on other projects. But then no projects came. So we were literally going to Times Square every day and just sort of sitting in a cubicle going, oh God, this is bad. So yeah, long story long. Yeah.
Do you think it was a success? Like looking back on it, do you qualify it as a success?
I think it was a success because we both learned so much. I also think it was a success because we're still friends. And now that I've heard so many founder stories, I'm like, she's still one of my best friends. So like that feels like a personal a personal success. But I do think it opened both of our eyes to like a world beyond straight media. It got me really interested in brand building, in marketing. It exposed me to VC. It really did kind of widen my world a bit. And I also feel proud of the product that we put out. And I learned a lot about email. And so for those reasons, it was a success. Am I like going to retire on that money? Absolutely not. There's no, you know, but so, you know, it depends which way you look at it. But we also went into this not thinking that we'd become billionaires. We went into it because we wanted a better sort of professional life for ourselves, but also a better publication for teenage girls.
Yeah. It was like this authentic desire to make something.
Yeah, truly authentic, like truly, truly authentic. And
I found an interview with as of today, I guess, laid off Vice staffer that you did a couple years ago. There was this moment where you were talking about why you started After School. And you said you wanted to be able to consolidate all these trends, track them, to be able to look back a year later. It was like this trend diary, this way, I think, for you to organize your own internet consumption and process it. So I guess that seems to be the mission statement, but I just love to hear you talk more about why you started After School. Because also, actually, so first you did the Clever Letter thing, then you went to New York Mag for a couple of years, and then you quit, and then you started After School. What was the flow
there? I knew I was leaving New York Magazine. I love the strategist. I love I love shopping content. I was really interested in that sort of affiliate market. I wanted to learn about affiliate revenue because that was such a hot, I mean, it still is, but like the wire cutters, the strategists, they were just killing it at that time. And I wanted to learn more about that. And I also think the world of New York Magazine. And so was awesome, but I was also there during the pandemic. So it was a little bleak because we were doing like the best masks you can wear or like that kind of, you know, it was. And so it was time to, you know, it just wasn't, I think I also learned that coming off of the Clover Letter experience of doing so much beyond editing, that just editing wasn't really doing it for me anymore. So knew that I'd put in my notice, and I have been freelance or, you know, with Clover Letter, like we were self-employed. So I know myself, and you can probably tell from just speaking to me, like I have high anxious energy. And I need something each day to sort of look back and be like, okay, I did that, like check that off, or else I just am sort of unmoored. And so I have always been super interested in youth trends, but with TikTok and everything that was happening, it felt like every day I was consuming all of this stuff and it was going like in one ear and out the other. And it felt like there were some macro insights to take away inside my brain, but they weren't living anywhere. And so I just remember for the month of April, every day I did after school without telling anybody. It was just like quiet, just to see like, does this feel good for my brain? Like, does this feel like a good exercise? Is there enough even on youth consumer trends to do it daily? What are the learnings here? Because when someone's like, I'm starting a newsletter, and they send out like one letter, and then I was afraid that I would be setting myself up for something untenable. And I think that like as creators, the best work comes from when you're doing something that you want to see exist. Like, I think we all read newsletters that were like, oh, this person is kind of phoning it in because they have this cadence that they now have to like stick to, but they don't know what to say, or they're clearly burnt out, whatever. So I just wanted to make sure it was something that felt personally fulfilling and also just like mentally feasible. And so then it was great. And so then May, 3 years ago, this coming May, sort of like went live with it, tweeting about it. And it's been like a slow and steady growth since then. And I've learned a lot in 3 years. And I do want to figure out how to condense all of that data in a way that is beyond just like existing in email form. But even just like to have, like be able to search back feels worthwhile.
I want to talk for a second more about that first month, writing to nobody, which I really like that. So many people, myself included, historically, like have that white page fear, right? Like whether it's a newsletter or a TikTok series, they want to start something. They have no idea how or what to do. I think clearly that's never been a problem for you ever since you were like 12 years old or whatever. How was it like writing to nobody? Did you really like set the bones of what it is now still then? Like, what was that?
Yeah.
Like?
Yeah, I recently was looking back. I can't remember what story I was digging back to see, but the format has changed a bit. I'm much more longer-winded now than I was back then. Like I'm obviously more comfortable in my opinions, but I also think that's from 3 years of researching this. I feel like I have more to say. But the bones still exist. And the one thing that has been more of a evolving thing is the paid weekend edition, but I do think for me, it's not the blank page is not terrifying. And also sending out an email to no one, I felt sort of protected. Like I didn't have my byline listed. Like I literally was like, no one knows this exists. This is just for me. But I still, then it's like, well, why even publish it? But I did. I don't know why, but then I added my byline. But for me, the sort of like fear comes from, what if I announce this thing or announce, tweet about it and no one cares? Or, and that's truly been like, I remember, when I was a kid, I started Teen Fashionista. I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't tell my classmates about it. I did not tell anyone about it. And I think that I've always had comfort between my online identity and my offline identity are separate. But I was recently talking to a cousin, and I don't really talk to my family about like my online identity much. And I've started to make TikToks because I've seen it helps my subscriber growth. And I posted my first reel, which was fucking terrifying because I do have personal friends and family following me on Instagram. And so putting myself out there in that way, you're like, am I in the group chat? Are they making fun of me in the group chats? But to a certain extent, you have to lean into the cringe, I think, especially if you want to grow online. Like if you're proud of what you're doing, like you have to just sort of say, fuck it. Probably someone is going to be like, can you believe her? She's trying to be an influencer or whatever. But yeah.
No, I mean, I forget like if this is where this comes from, but there's that line, like, don't kill the part of yourself that's cringe, kill the part of yourself that cringes or whatever, which I think is really...
Oh, I love really that. I've not heard that. That's
yeah,
so good.
I don't know where it's from, but yeah. But no, so I was looking at your socials, obviously, and I noticed that you've posted on Instagram 16 times in the past decade. But then looking at your TikTok, which you told Brad Esposito in April 2022 that you don't spend much time on TikTok.
That has changed.
What changed?
Let me tell you.
Yeah.
So, actually, just to finish my previous, I was talking to a cousin who doesn't know about my online stuff as much, and she is also a couple years younger than me, therefore like more plugged in a way. And she was like, "Yeah, a couple of my friends have said that you've been coming up on their FYPs," and I was like, "Oh God, that is horrible to hear." Like, because I just, I can't be the only person who like once, and you know, I'm sure even you brought up how long gone. I bet it's, and not to compare myself to them, I love them, I'm a goner, but I bet it's probably weird and a little uncomfortable when, you know, someone brings up something they say on the podcast and it's like, wait, I didn't tell you that. That's on the pod, you know? And so I think in order to, for our online and offline selves to coexist, we have to like lean into the cringe. But to answer your question about TikTok. So I want to say in the last year, I can tell you exactly. As TikTok, as Twitter, I used to be huge on Twitter, or huge into Twitter constantly. That was my go-to sort of scrolling, standing in line. And then once the Elon stuff happened and the algorithms got so bad and people are posting less, it's like, I just don't find the same. I don't think it's as amusing. Like, I just don't get the same sort of satisfaction out of it. So when Twitter was like constantly disappointing, when Twitter was constantly disappointing me, I was like, okay, I'm gonna try and figure out TikTok in earnest, at least with my FYP. Like, I have a dog. I don't want to see dogs. I don't want to see, you know, like, I don't want to see this content. I want it to see trend content. I want to see shopping hauls. I want to know what consumers are doing, and I'm going to try to train my algorithm in earnest. And it has been, I get so much satisfaction from scrolling on TikTok now. Like, I routinely laugh out loud at stuff. Like, it's like I'm obsessed with my feed because, you know, of course it's in many ways a reflection of your interest, but TikTok for me is like such a purely good thing with scrolling. I will say that posting for me is a little more fraught. I do not read the comments. Like, just don't. I have a hard rule against that, just because I don't take like any sort of I have extremely thin skin, and so I just opt out of looking at the comments. And I also I want to get into a rhythm where I posted a lot over holiday break because I had more time, but I want to get in a rhythm where I'm posting, you know, daily. But I also think that there are limitations to TikTok in terms of like, yes, it's a fun thing, but like at this point, I think in terms of like professional growth, I think there are serious limitations just because people aren't growing on TikTok the same way they used to be.
Speaking of like how you've scaled your posting, like I was looking and now it's like, it feels like most of your videos get over 100,000 views, some of them less, but you've got like multiple with millions of views. The Stanley one was like, I think your biggest. And that's all in like the past 3 or 4 months. I think you only first posted like last, like 8 months ago now or something like that. So like, what, like, did it really like boost you too once you started getting like actual engagement? Like, I know you're not reading the comments, but you're seeing the view count and it's like insane. So how did that feel, like, as somebody who fears this kind of parasocial two-way mirror?
I haven't gotten into like a regular rhythm of posting, and I think that might help. But I will say, just in terms of seeing the sources on my subscribers, I really did not think TikTok would translate to newsletter subscribers. I was really trying it as an experiment and just to do it, you know, just to see, because I feel like there is a little bit in all of us in 2024 of like, could I go viral? Could I? Like, I don't know. Maybe I can't, but like, could I? And so with like the Stanley thing, like, I just felt really like, obviously Stanleys are on their way out. Like, I was astounded by how many Christmas hauls included Stanleys. They were tween and sometimes even younger girls. Like, there's literally no way that this trend is going to keep going up, 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 because they're literally 11-year-olds are excited about this purchase. So therefore, a 25-year-old or 22-year-old is not going to be wanting to carry this thing around. Like, that's just the way that trend cycles work. And so, but I also, yeah, so I felt pretty confident that that one would do decent numbers. I did not expect it to yield what it did. But yeah, I would say in terms of just, you know, most Substack, but Beehive, I'm sure too, you can see the source. And so seeing that it comes through from TikTok, it's sort of like, holy shit, like people are clicking through on my profile and signing up, which just really surprises me.
Yeah, no, I mean, that infamously, it's hard to get people to click out of TikTok.
Yeah.
Can we talk about your newsletter growth? I think you're at 38,000 subscribers now in like almost exactly 3 years. It'll be in a couple months, it'll be 3 years. Tell me about, like, I guess, like the path from like 0 to 10 to 100 to 1,000 to 10, like kind of those big milestones, how it progressed.
So having scaled or grown Clover Letter, and also to a lesser extent, having worked on Teen Vogue's newsletter strategy back in the day, like I had a pretty good sense of like what is good numbers versus what is not good numbers in terms of open rate and also just sheer size. And I'm sure it's different now, but like I can speak to like Teen Vogue's list in 2015 was massive, but the open rate was terrible because sort of what we ran into with Clover, which was like the high school, the college, the .edu ones. But so I wanted to approach after school differently because I wasn't trying to scale this. I was trying to do something for my own brain. And I felt really strongly of like, if others do benefit from this, great. But like, I truly was just trying to like find something that worked for me. So what was really gratifying and, you know, I wasn't seeing like scale. It's not like overnight I was at 10,000 subscribers. It was slow and steady, but I felt good about that because my open rate was really high. And because I was seeing the beauty of an email newsletter is you, for the most part, you know who's signing up. So I was seeing Nike and, you know, Instagram and huge and agencies. And it was such a thrill to like see these people like signing up for my newsletter. And so just seeing the, and I at a certain point, like the newsletter growth was so slow and steady that I was literally looking up every person like, oh my gosh. And for a while I had a list of like the CMO of, you know, Red Bull or whatever. And I do not do that anymore, although I should. I think it was probably a really like worthwhile exercise because
this was probably when you didn't have a full-time job too, right?
Exactly.
When
you were like, exactly. Yeah. But so that I that really encouraged me, even though the growth wasn't lightning fast. And I have never done any sort of like growth exchange. And in fact, I do think that's probably a missed opportunity or something I would like to pursue in the future, as so much of newsletter growth comes from cross promotion. And so like Brad featuring me, I gave him a shout out, but if I had interviewed Brad in, you know, like, I think that there is a lot of value in those cases. But because of my format and because, you know, the short daily, I think there's an opportunity to do some interviews in the long, in the weekend one. But also with my full-time job, I haven't been able to, explore that, but it is something that is on my mind. But yeah, slow and steady growth. And, there have been no like lightning bolts or anything, but you know, anytime someone, you know, a tweet or someone gives me a shout in their newsletter, or in the last couple of months, I've been in a lot of articles as, you know, as a source, and it's been really interesting to see like what does make a difference and what doesn't.
Yeah. I was wondering if your current job like came about at all through the newsletter, because it seemed like working at a VC firm, you know, you in a comms and content role, they probably want your trend insights. I would imagine, like, was that related?
So I'm about to hit a year on my job, and I am I'm actively transitioning out because I'm going to do after school full time. It just, it's with the team's blessing, but basically I've just been burning the candle at both ends. And, the weekend takes the entire weekend really to do. And so I've just truly been working like every, like, and look, we all work a lot, but I just, you know, working for a VC is not a 9-to-5. And yeah. So coming into the new year, I saw a lot of growth and I was like, shit, like, seems like there's an opportunity here that I'm really not able to explore because I'm just don't have the energy or the time. So I'm planning to like add a pro offering that's more for brands, that's more of a monthly deep dive, which is why the having the brand emails will come in handy, because I can do some direct outreach of like, hey, I'm getting ready to launch this thing. But to answer, to back up, so I definitely do think that the newsletter helped. And I think that especially for the team that I work, like Alexis is truly a content enthusiast. He so respects the side hustle. He so respects content creators. Also, he's obsessed with Beehive, just so you guys know. So he's constantly like, are you going to move to Beehive? Like,
I mean...
So I do think it helped in that way, because he like having him as a boss, like also helped me like get comfortable with a front facing camera and trying different content formats out, because he is, you know, it helps to have someone who's sort of fearless in that, in content creation.
I counted links in a few of your newsletters. And I think like my question really is like, how do you source your content? Because it's insane. Like, I think the format for a regular weekday edition is like, there's like the, what is it like? I've read it ever this somewhere. It's like five or six links in the top that are like kind of more tabloidy, gossipy, I feel like is the difference. And then below is like six to seven that are more long form news articles with more context. And then in the, I checked this morning, I looked at a couple of the extra credits, went through them, and I counted 74 links, not including TikToks or Spotify embeds, 74, you know, anchor text links. So that's crazy. That's like a lot.
Did you manually count?
I did.
Okay, because I've often thought it would be a fun metric to include of like how many links, but
you should. That's a good hook.
Yeah.
But my question is like, so one, like, how are you sourcing this content? And then two, how much time are you spending on the newsletter each week?
So it's interesting. When I first started, I was very reliant on Google Alerts. So I had like some keywords like Gen Z, youth, things like that. And then in the first like 3 months of doing after school, Google Alerts went to shit. Like, I don't know what happened, but it's like the news sources that they use are terrible. Like, and so I really had to, I was sort of like, okay, need to rethink here. And so I don't want to give away too much because I do have like a pretty intense.
Hold your cards if you need.
But I will say I have a very large number of sites that I read at least the headlines of every day. Mm-hmm. But I also like, I've experimented with having keywords set, like Google News, you know, looking at Gen Z helps a bit. And I do that every day just to make sure. And like, sometimes I'll search teenagers, but Google News search is also really bad. And so, but I also take it very personally if I miss some sort of like trend scoop or like something, I'm like, shit, I should have included that. So I think probably you could boil down the publications that I regularly link to. I probably link to like 20 outlets frequently, and then maybe like 50 outlets, you know, regularly. And I kind of know, like, I should check Wall Street Journal every day, check New York Times every day. Though honestly, like, it's a workflow that I'm constantly trying to improve upon, because I try to also report on any general youth trends, but like many youth trends don't include Gen Z in the headline. So it's a lot of just like having to read everything or at least skim sites. And there's no like shortcut really. There's some like sort of depending on the day, like depending on how, I mean, I also am like a scrolling maniac. So I have a terrible attention span, as all of us do these days. And so I shouldn't admit this to in front of my colleagues, but like when I'm on Zooms, I'm listening, but I'm also like maniacally scrolling. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's hard to do that with TikTok. I can't do that with TikTok, but that's why I miss like having a better Twitter, because I used to source so much from Twitter. that I just don't anymore. But yeah, I think probably to answer your question about how much time. So I chip away at the weekend one pretty much all week. I'm filing away headlines of like, that's not quite good enough for the daily, but I think it might ladder up to a larger trend for the weekend. So I'm constantly filing away. So my weekend is a work in progress. Honestly, a couple of weeks ago, I was sick and I accidentally sent out like a newsletter with all of my overflow at the bottom, because I throughout the day am adding links to straight into the newsletter doc. And so it, you know, and then I do the one last thought, which is a TikTok embed, and I had all of the overflow below it. That usually I grab that overflow and then I put it into the weekend. So yeah.
that's a lot. Do you have like an hour estimate for like the whole, it's like every waking hour of your life, any moment you're looking at your phone, but like the whole project, and then like vaguely how much time you spend, like, again, you kind of already said you don't, but like,
yeah,
maybe like on a normal weekday issue, is that like an hour, 3 hour, like,
yeah, it's hard because I'm doing so much of the sort of background scrolling, shall we, you know, just like,
which is the real work.
But I will say in the morning, I wake up at like 6:30 on a good day. It's hard because when it doesn't get light until 7, it's sort of like, but I spend probably 45 minutes to an hour on it in the morning before I send it. And then I'm doing the pre-work the day before. And so I usually have a good idea of what I want to say, but I like to do the sort of final 45 minutes or whatever work in the morning, because if anything big came up overnight, I like to include that. Or my brain's just also fresher in the morning. You know, I'm like drinking my coffee and I feel like I'm wittier. But I will say also the sort of workflow of that has changed over time based on my job. Like when I first started after school, I did send it around 4 o'clock. Every day.
Four
after school. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, duh. That's
and so I'd sort of work on it during my day, and then I'd try and get it out, you know, and later in the afternoon. And then given like, even before taking a full-time job, just like projects and stuff, it's really hard to like carve out that time in the middle of the day. So I shifted it to the morning. And for a while I was doing the entire thing the night before and scheduling it for 6:50 or whatever. But then I like to give it a fresh look in the morning.
So you're pressing send manually?
Oh yes.
Or you were? Amazing. That's crazy.
I press send manually every single day. I used to schedule it out.
Wow. I feel like that's so uncommon. I mean, not that I've talked to everyone with a newsletter, but like with Creator Spotlight, I schedule, and with my little personal one, I schedule too. And That's wild to me. You're really like riding the edge of the wave.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Let's get into monetization stuff. So I see you like kind of very rarely sell ads, but sometimes there are. There was one the other day for like Day One Agency. And then you have premium subscribers. So tell me like when monetization came into the picture and like what's the monetization story?
Yeah, so I'd been doing it for a couple of months and I was getting good feedback, and I think I was probably at 5,000 subscribers, and thought, I mean, I don't know how much I should talk about Substack, but I think at that time Substack was saying you should expect 10% to convert. And so I thought, okay, if I have 5,000 subscribers and I could get 500 paid, like that, you know, is not nothing. So by July, I had 2,000 subscribers, and that's when I turned it on. Okay, the way Substack, they put paid separate from all, and so it's very confusing. Yeah. But so I can tell you that on my first send, 19 of 2,000 converted.
That's not bad. It wasn't in my mind.
It was not bad, but then there were like many weekends where I was sending it to, you know, 20 people, and I was putting so much work into it, and it sort of felt like I'm putting so much work into this and 20 people are reading it. But then it grows. It grows slow and steady, and you're also like, these people believe in me, and their buy-in is enough for me to spend this time doing this. And I felt with my weekend especially, I spend so much time deep diving, do it weird rabbit holes. And I feel like I come out of it having learned so much that because it's worth it, I learned so much myself that it's like worth it for me, especially because it's paid now. But like, even so, you know, if I was doing like a navel gazing personal essay, like I don't, well, that's also, I wouldn't do that. But, you know, I feel like such an intellectual payoff of like learning about all these brands and things that people are doing on TikTok. And it all, I always feel the payoff. So I'm so glad I like, not to like be like, you should also stay with it, you know, newsletter writer, but to go from 20 to like what it is now, which is, I will be just totally candid with you. It's, I'm at 38% or 38,000 subscribers. And I've consistently had about 5% convert. So we're looking at, you know, a good amount. I mean, 5% is, it's been steady that it's never risen, but I still feel, you know, it's a good amount of money now. And I have explored partnerships and ads. I'm really interested in Beehive's tools around that because I don't have the bandwidth myself to sort of activate that muscle. And like in the last year that I've had this full-time job, I've had brands reach out and I like honestly leave them on read because I'm like, I can't. So the day one thing was like a year long partnership. So I like really didn't have to think about it. Like they're easy to work with. And, but for these one-offs, it's like, I don't know that it's worth it for me. The back and forth for a couple of $100 or even $1,000, the sort of like brain space it takes.
Have there been any like specific things or themes that you find really drive the premiums, or is it like, you know, just kind of like the steady 5% you said, or was there like some issue you put out that was like, wow, I got 100 premiums off this one issue?
Yeah. Anytime I do like a TikTok haul deep dive, so like the Christmas list haul and the back to school haul, those always convert big time. Those are unfortunately not easily replicable. Like, it's not like I can do that every week. Like, well, girls aren't.
That's what. Yeah. Are.
But yeah, though this Christmas list haul converted a lot. I also was lucky enough to be on CNBC live TV talking of like, you know, the like public markets like segment where like finance guys are watching. And that was really funny because I know nothing about finance and they wanted to talk about Stanley's and the implications of that on the public market. And immediately after I had a lot of subscribers paid and otherwise, but that converted a lot because I think those people who are working on private market or public markets, they have big budgets and they also need to know shifts, consumer shifts. So I had a lot of like analysts connecting with me on LinkedIn, which has never happened before.
That's amazing. No, that makes sense. Cause that's, well, going back to the audience question again, yeah. Like you were saying how like, I think you said that you were surprised by how many teens who want to know about their peers kind of started subscribing compared to like the people, you know, I would say like the people selling the pickaxes, so to speak.
Yeah.
Do you know like approximately what the split of that is in your audience?
No, and I need to do a survey to get this information. Like I should know this. I really have no idea. A couple of months ago, I did ask the breakdown of who is reading for fun versus for work. And I think it was about 50-50. And so that's interesting because I actually had an interesting conversation a couple of months ago with a friend who's in like media biz dev. And I was telling her that, you know, for a newsletter that is so B2B, like that kind of limits my partnerships or like ad, you know, it's only so many ad or like brands would be interested in sponsoring. And she said, I don't view you as B2B. And I was like, what? Like what? And it kind of like, it was sort of eye-opening to think about that. Like there is a contingent of just people who want to know about trends and young people reading that it's not necessarily B2B, but also B2B versus B2C. I think a lot of those categories are sort of shifting because so many of us want to know about sales data and, you know, a lot of these trends do have larger implications on the world, even if not our jobs. So it feels like an interesting time for like market research, because we are endlessly curious about what younger generations are doing, but we're also curious about those larger implications.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And like, I feel like B2B, B2C lines blur. Like with Beehive, it's like, technically you could call it a B2B SaaS, but like so many of those Bs are like, you know, more consumers, individual creatives who like, I don't know, the lines start to blur, and like B2B marketers are taking cues from B2C, et cetera, et cetera. And like, when I read it too, like I don't necessarily always read the whole thing, but it's like, even if there's like, oh, this is some, you know, article of the day, article of the week that I read this morning or last night, what did Casey think about it? What's the hot take that like, does that resonate with my take? Does that, you know, add to my take? Like, even just that, like, you know, because the things, it's just like the culture, maybe it's just, you know, I'm somebody who lives in New York and like kind of vaguely works in this kind of media.
Yeah.
So it's like, these are the just things I'm interested in already, but it's like, as a consumer, I don't know, I'm just rambling, but you're just another voice I want to hear, right?
Yeah. I think you just hit on something too, I think, where we're consuming so much every day, and especially like some of these trend stories or whatever, we look at them and we try to give them a close read, but maybe our attention wanes or whatever. And then maybe you're like, well, what is the quote? What is the meat here? What's the important thing to take away? And that is what I try to do in the newsletter, is like, what is the quote that is like, has the largest impact here? Or what is the kernel of like interesting thing in here? Because I think, I mean, we're just bombarded with information. And I think this is especially true for brand marketers, where it's like you're seeing campaign after campaign, and it's like, okay, what is the takeaway though? Like, what do I make of this? And how is this actionable, whether I am a brand marketer or just a human who wants to know interesting things?
Yeah. Because it's such a link heavy thing, are you comfortable sharing like the click rate on average?
Oh, yeah. Let's see.
What we're just talking about, it's like, it's the one quote or whatever. So it's like, the point is that you don't necessarily need to click.
I know. See, that's the thing. I don't necessarily like make it so that you need to click. And that's what I hope too, because a lot of the stuff I'm sharing is, you know, so much is behind a paywall these days that I'm trying to like identify here. Let's see. This one has 12% clicked a link.
Wow. That's quite good, I feel like.
What's like industry average? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm like not enough of an industry person. I think it's quite low. I think it's between 1 and 2. Okay, in 2022, average click rates for Beehive newsletters were 1.79, and in 2023 they went up to 1.85.
Oh wow. Okay, cool.
Yes, you're killing it.
Wow, that's great to know. I really don't know. Like, I only pay attention to open rate because, mm-hmm. you know, that's such a...
Are you comfortable sharing your open rate?
So, yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah. So it's usually around 60%. I like to keep it around 60%. With the Stanley Tumblr, like, sort of press blitz that happened, I got a lot of, So I hit 30K subscribers, I think on like right around the end of the year. And so now I'm at 38, which is like truly like a big, so I need to do a purge because I like to keep it around 60. So right now it's probably like closer to 55.
That's very good. That's really good. Wow. So the Stanley piece really, is that what you're attributing that growth to? Those 8,000 people?
So it was like a number of things. It's like, the TikTok, I went semi-viral, and then Business Insider reached out to me about doing a, like, this trend watcher thinks that Stanleys are on their way out.
They've been doing a lot of these recently, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so then that sort of, like, was a bump. And then there was a New York Times thing, and then that was a bump. And then the CNBC thing was a bump. And then it seems like there was one other thing.
There was the New York Mag teen shopping thing.
Yeah, the New York Mag shopping thing happened last Friday, and that definitely was a bump. It's just been like a lot has happened in the new year, but, the growth, I've not seen anything like this, but I do know, you know, I'm like tempering my like excitement, 'cause it's like some of these will be lower quality because they're, you know, that's just the nature of it. So
yeah, before we get into maybe some bigger picture questions, I am curious about like the financial side. Like, are you able to support yourself with the premium subscriptions by now? Or like, what's, is that, I mean, obviously you're going to try to bring that up with the new pro plan, but yeah, what, how are the financials? How do you feel about them? Can you share any specifics?
I would say I feel like I could definitely support myself. I've had a full-time job this last year. So that's been nice to have, but it's also like been very hard on like my personal, you know, like yeah. It has been very, mentally hard to do both. And so, but I feel like subscriptions plus, especially a little bit of ad revenue or partnerships, and then plus this like pro thing that I'm going to try, which is inspired by, something that I've looked to as inspiration is Ryan Broderick's Garbage Day. He does a pro. He does like an interesting monthly, like sort of recap and data dive. And that got me thinking like, oh, there's, because if you think about my dailies as like micro trends, there's some interesting macro stuff to sort of like look back of like, what the hell happened this month? What actually should I take into the next month? So I'm going to try it.
It's like one to many. It's a one to many consultancy.
Exactly.
Okay. Moving on to some other stuff. So we kind of touched on this at the beginning of this, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot. What I'll share my definition after you share yours, but what is the definition of a creator in the sense that we're talking about it here?
It's interesting that you asked. So I would say a year ago, I was not comfortable with a creator title. A couple of like creator, you know, SaaS company or like outbound, like I got some salespeople of different creator startups or whatever reaching out to me for, you know, very like you understand. And I kind of was like, I'm not a creator. Like, and then especially now that I've been posting on TikTok and now I've gotten more comfortable with like so many of us are creators. Creator is not influence. Like I think the, mm-hmm. I view it as anybody who is putting their creations online largely. I mean, of course there are offline creators too, I guess, but for the purposes of this conversation and our definition, I think it is anybody who is creating content, whether it is YouTube or TikTok or newsletters. And so often many of those things.
It's such an all-encompassing word. Let me share what I wrote, which I put this on like the about page of the Creator Spotlight page. So it's one is consistently publishing content online. Pace doesn't matter as long as there's a consistent output and content generally, again, which is kind of why I think people have this weird association, like you're kind of, you know, backing off of it previously. It's like, it's just so generalist. Anyways, consistently publishing content online. Number two is a direct connection or relationship between the creator and their audience, maybe mediated by a platform, but not mediated by an editor or something like that. So like, you know, a New York Times journalist might not, I wouldn't call them a creator, but if they also have like a Substack on the side in that capacity, they're a creator. The third thing, which is like those first two, I think are like always for me. And then the third is that they're monetizing, whether through subscriptions, mm-hmm. paid courses, platform payouts, ads, brand deals, tips, or even like, you know, long tail, this is helping my career type plays. But I think that one is like so broad and like, I think it's those three things, but especially the first two, consistently publishing content online and having this relationship with their audience that's unmediated.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I'm curious, do you think that you have to monetize in order to be a creator?
I don't think so. Again, I'm going to go back to something you said in a recent newsletter. You said about Pookie and Jet. Love Pookie and Jet. They're going viral for documenting their lives, but they're not living their lives in hopes of going viral, which I misread it at first of like, I thought it said like, they're not creating content in terms of, in hopes of going viral, which of course they are. Pookie used to have like a fashion blog too, like that is kind of defunct now a few years ago. There's this degree of intention that I'm also kind of putting into it because there could be like some, you know, kid who's like making, who's just kind of like just so out there and they're just making this crazy content and it's just so weird and it's not really monetizable or whatever, but they've got a million followers and like, I couldn't interview them because like, what are we going to talk about for an hour, right? Like how am I going to extract learnings from my audience? So are they a creator? Which is why I kind of put this monetization thing on there because that adds an intentionality.
Yep. Layer.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm curious by that. Would you consider Pookie and Jet creators?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. She's got brand deals. Well, and it's so clear that it's intentional. Like I said, I when I was looking them up a couple months ago, it's like I found her fashion blog that I think is defunct, and it refers to like them being newlyweds. So it's clearly from like 2018 or whatever. So like she is, and it's just taken her a while to take off. But so there's no desperate, like there's no need. Because Jet is like a mergers and acquisitions lawyer. Anyways, now we're just going very off script. I don't think any of this will make it to the newsletter. But I was interested to hear your opinion because I like respect you as like an internet, you know, trend forecasting person who would have good opinions about this. So this is more like research for how I do this newsletter.
Yeah, I think the thing about Pookie and Jet that people do pick up on, and this is my sort of like thought about social media in 2024. That we are looking for, we are all online enough to know when people are creating content for the sake of creating content. Mm-hmm. I truly believe their shtick is not a shtick. I believe that is their very genuine, like, sort of thing that they do. I do not believe that him calling her, like, I don't think they were sitting around thinking, like, let's think of, like, a thing that would help propel us. And I was reading today about this couple. It was in Business Insider about like it was like this couple are the biggest trolls on TikTok, and it was about this couple who like literally all of their videos are trolling, and many people are in on the joke. Like they're absolutely absurd. I'll send you a link, but you know these people are trolling. They've created a shtick that they believe will get them viral clicks.
I found it. This husband and wife duo. Yeah.
Yes. And I think there's an authenticity to, I mean, obviously this is also resonating for some reason, this troll thing, like these trolls, but I think that the authenticity of Pookie and Jet, it just resonates where it's like, you can tell that they're not like reading a script. You can tell that they're not necessarily, I mean, maybe they're trying to like play it up a bit now, but
that's the thing.
But like when they were taking off, like it just felt so authentic and very like to be a fly on the wall. And I think that is really appealing where it's like, yes, they are creators, but they're not playing a part for views.
Question for you though. How much money do you spend on creator subscriptions, other newsletters, et cetera, compared to your traditional media subscriptions?
A lot. I spend a lot of money on both, I would say, because I spend a lot on both for the newsletter, really. So it's like, I want to make sure, like I recently just paid for, but I recently paid for Ad Age, which was one of the, I was holding out. I really did not, because I already pay for Ad Week, but they do a lot of Gen Z brand content. And it's like, I don't want to miss out on an interesting story because I'm too much of a cheapskate. Although then it, you know, you do sort of, something I hear from a lot of people, subscribers are like, and I feel this sentiment, like some of my favorite newsletters I don't pay for. And it's because I have only so much time to leisurely read. And I feel like I can't get to the paid or, you know, whatever. I have enough content to keep me satiated as it is. And to then pay for more content, it's like, I don't even have time to read the content I already get. Therefore, why would I pay for more? And I think a lot of people run into that with creators like myself, where it's like, I like you and I like your free one, but I simply don't have time to read your weekend one, which
your job is to read content already anyways. So like,
So I get that. I get the whole, and I do think we're going to run into that more and more where it's like, we all have, many of us have interest, are doing interesting things on the internet and are trying to make a living. But at the same time, many of us are on budgets and are trying to reel in our expenses, and we're already paying for Netflix and Hulu. And like, it's just like, we could just see all of our monthly check go to rent and all of our little monthly subscriptions I try to keep my subscriptions in check, but I don't. I would guess it's a 50-50 split between creators, newsletters, and then traditional media. A 50-50 split probably in terms of volume of subscriptions. I don't know about financial split, just because some of the publications that I now pay for because of my newsletter, the information added, like these sort of like industry publications are expensive.
The information, oh my God. Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was missing a lot of like key context on some of these startup stories. And so I paid for it thinking that it would be a write-off for my 9-to-5. But now that I'm leaving, I'm going to keep paying for it because I do feel like their reporting is so good and their paywall is so solid that there's just no way to get that without.
12-foot ladder is not getting over that. How do you think about your responsibility to your specific audience and what kind of like editorial standards do you impose on yourself, if any?
Broadly, from an ethical standpoint, I try to make sure that I'm linking to things that are fairly reported, but a lot of times occasionally I'll link to something that I think is bad reporting, but I think it's important to share around the point of view, but in acknowledging that it is bad or that it is an important point of view to be aware of by acknowledging and also acknowledge that it, you know, and like sometimes I'll link to stuff where I think it's like poorly edited or even occasionally poorly reported, but still think that there is something important to highlight there where it's like, there's a lot of underreporting that happens, I think, where especially on youth, where it's like, they're talking about what's happening on TikTok, but they're not actually talking to any young people, which really irks me. But I also know the pressures on journalists to turn things around. So I understand it. Something else I do is, you know, every once in a while, I get on a high horse about bad sponsored content and the ethics around that and high snobiety, I think it is, does a lot of sponsored content that is not clear that it's sponsored, which like also really irks me. But a lot of times it'll be like interesting enough to even highlight as a brand example. So I think the thing that having your own newsletter affords you is the space to talk direct. You know, it's like if I was writing this for the New York Times, I wouldn't be able to sort of talk directly to the person and say, I think it's kind of shitty that they hid that this is sponsored, but I think it's notable because they're obviously trying to get in front of young people or Gaza stuff. Like, I think it is bad that they did it this way, but I think it's also important to understand that this is trending on TikTok at the same time. Yeah, it's hard to navigate sometimes, I think, but I do believe being a newsletter writer versus a journalist, you're able to just admit to your own personal, like, I think this, I'm not sure, would love to hear your thoughts, or like it could be more of a dialogue versus, you know, this is the story.
That's really interesting, which this is like what I was talking about with my kind of second tenet of what is a creator, with the unmediated aspect, because people talk a lot about like, you know, losing media literacy and stuff, but I feel like I hope that people understand that like when it's a creator, it's baked in.
You know, sometimes I see like TikTok creator Alex Earl or people like this film a TikTok and the comments are all like, I feel like I was just getting a FaceTime message from a friend. Like, I think there is a sense of like, it's the thing I love about being a newsletter writer is like being able to talk directly to the audience as if they are my friend, because if they have feedback or thoughts or an opinion to add, like they'll probably hit reply. It makes it more of a like more of a dialogue than just publishing a piece in a newspaper.
Okay, one more question. What if you were 13 today, would you be writing a teen fashionista blog, or what would you be doing?
If I was 13 today?
Yeah, what would be the teenfashionista.com?
Man, this is hard because the natural platform would be TikTok, but I love writing. I do think that
13-year-olds start newsletters. Sorry, I'm interrupting you.
No, I do think blogs will make a comeback, but I think that it is sort of a next gen sort of take on blogs, much like Beehive's. Like, I love the Beehive Substack platform where it exists as both. And that when we did Clover Letter, that was before there were these platforms. So it was on MailChimp and it just lived. There was no archive, really. And so I love that blogs are coming back in a way through newsletters. And I think that we're going to continue seeing interesting features. At least it is my hope. But I think, I think Teen Fashionista would be, because I love writing, probably a newsletter. And I would probably have to be on TikTok too.
You would be being round up by the U equivalent doing Christmas hauls when you were doing your Christmas haul
Exactly.
of
But
Brandy
man,
Noble.
oh, I think about like I just knew nothing then, you know? I was so naive living in rural Missouri, like but who knows how different my life would be now because I would have access via TikTok and the internet to so many more things. Like truly my glimpse into the world was through teen magazines and MTV. So I what's some I mean this is just trend like background, but my mom is the teacher at my school that I went to, and she was telling me that after the holidays, all of the middle school girls showed up with their Lululemon flares, their crossbody bags, their Stanleys. It's wild to me because the trends used to reach my small town several years after New York. Certainly, they'd hit St. Louis and then my small town finally. And it's wild to think that these girls are on the same trend sort of cycle as girls in New York. Like the sort of collapsing of culture is fascinating in that way.